history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there which really need to be told. And we're never going to enjoy the privilege of hearing them unless we take the initiative to ask a few questions and then take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And you know what? When we do that, we end up so thankful we did. We're educated, we're entertained, often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We've been marking 75th anniversaries from the final year of World War II, and this week, it's a big one, VE Day. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com for a link to the VE Day commemoration stream from the Friends of the National World War II Memorial. Victory in Europe for the Allied forces 75 years ago meant different things to different people. To civilians throughout Europe, it meant the end of Nazi oppression. To American servicemen and women, it meant maybe a chance to return home, unless Uncle Sam decided to send you to the Pacific, where war would last another 3 months. For newly liberated American prisoners of war, it was a huge relief. They knew the freedom they had just regained would not be taken away. We're going to hear some of those perspectives today, but first, let's do something we probably don't do often enough on this program. Listen to what Americans would have heard 75 years ago, maybe even on the same radio station you're listening to the program on right now. Harry Truman had been president for less than a month since the passing of Franklin D. Roosevelt, but Truman had the privilege of sharing with the American people on May 8, 1945, the news they'd been hoping to hear for years.
This is a solemn but a glorious hour. I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe. For this victory, we join in offering our thanks to the providence which has guided and sustained us through the dark days of adversity. And now I want to read to you my formal proclamation of this occasion. The Allied armies, through sacrifice and devotion, and with God's help, have wrung from Germany a final and unconditional surrender. The Western world has been freed of the evil forces which for 5 years and longer have imprisoned the bodies and broken the lives of millions upon millions of freeborn men. They have violated their churches, destroyed their homes, corrupted their children, and murdered their loved ones. Our armies of liberation have restored freedom to these suffering people, whose spirit and will the oppressors could never enslave. United, the peace-loving nations have demonstrated in the West that their arms are stronger by far than the might of the dictators or the tyranny of military cliques. The power of our peoples to defend themselves against all enemies will be proved in the Pacific War as it has been proved in Europe. For the triumph of spirit and of arms which we have won, and for its promise to the peoples everywhere who join us in the love of freedom, it is fitting that we, as a nation, give thanks to Almighty God, who has strengthened us and given us the victory. Now, therefore, I, Harry S. Truman, President of the United States of America, do hereby appoint Sunday, May 13, 1945, to be a day of prayer. I call upon the people of the United States, whatever their faith, to unite in offering joyful thanks to God for the victory we have won, and to pray that He will support us to the end of our present struggle and guide us into the ways of peace. I also call upon my countrymen to dedicate this day of prayer to the memory of those who have given their lives to make possible our victory.
President Harry Truman on May 8, 1945, the official day of Nazi Germany's unconditional surrender to Allied forces in Europe. You heard the president say General Eisenhower had informed him of that news, and there's quite a story behind that. It came in a 74-word coded message from the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Forces in Reims, France. The man chosen to send that message is still living, and I spoke with him this week just before he was set to board a plane from Arizona to Washington, D.C. to be honored at the White House by President Trump. Gregory Malikian is 96 years old now, but still very energetic. Greg promised me he'd share his story here on Hometown Heroes after returning from his latest adventure, so we can look forward to that. And after General Eisenhower's coded message went out, after Truman shared the news with the country, Eisenhower had his own words to share with the world on behalf of all the Americans serving under him.
I have the proud privilege speaking for a victorious army of almost 5 million fighting men. They and the women who have so ably assisted them constitute the Allied Expeditionary Forces that have liberated Western Europe. They have captured or destroyed enemy armies totaling more than their own strength. Merely to name my principal subordinates in the Canadian, French, American, and British forces is to present a picture of the utmost in efficiency, skill, loyalty, and devotion to duty. The United Nations will gratefully remember Tedder, Montgomery, Spots, Bradley, DeLock, Creer, and many others. But all these agree with me in the selection of the truly heroic figure of this war. He is G.I. Joe and his counterpart in the Air, the Navy, and the Merchant Marine of every one of the United Nations. He has braved the dangers of U-boat-infested seas. He has surmounted charges into desperately defended beaches. He has fought his tedious, patient way through the ultimate in fortified zones. He has endured cold, hunger, fatigue. His companion has been danger. Death has dogged his footsteps. He and his platoon commanders have given us an example of loyalty, devotion to duty, and indomitable courage that will live in our hearts as long as we admire those qualities in men.
General Dwight Eisenhower praising the American GI in the wake of the Allied victory in Europe 75 years ago. So you've heard from the president and the top general, but what did it mean to the men and women in uniform? We're going to spend the rest of our hour hearing how and where some of them experienced VE Day, and in some cases we'll need a little build-up to that to put it in perspective. Some of these veterans are still with us, others have passed, but their VE Day stories and all their World War II memories remain. Luis Rodriguez had been picking oranges in Exeter, California when the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor pulled America into World War II. He had survived the Battle of the Bulge and plenty of close calls with the 240th Field Artillery Battalion, which fired its final shots about a week before the official surrender.
May the 1st, that morning, early in the morning, we fired our last shot. It was one of those wet days. It had been snowing and of course, it was warmer weather. The snow was melting and made the ground very, very muddy. But we were supporting the 14th Armored Division, a good division, and along with the 99th Infantry Division. And they were some of their troops more or less stayed where we were at. And we were wondering what in the world was going on. We're not moving, no orders, no nothing. So what had happened was that the front was moving so fast that the armored division no longer needed us, so they retired us from duty, and we were told to go back and establish a place to stay until we were called. And knowing what was going on, we knew better that we had fired our last shot in Europe, and that's the way it was.
You have a frame of General Dwight Eisenhower's order of the day from May 5th, 1945. When he talks about the crusade that the Allies had been on since the summer of 44, reaching its glorious conclusion. Do you remember hearing those words or reading those words from your commander and feeling anything specific about that?
I sure do. I'll never forget that day. It was an article in we used to get a newspaper whenever we could get it, Stars and Stripes newspaper. And on it was, in the front page, was this letter written from General Eisenhower. And it was something that we had dreamed up for 9 months. And here the day had arrived that all guns had gone to rest and we no longer needed to fire anything. And we wondered what our next duties would be. And it didn't take us long to find out. We were pulled into occupation of Germany.
Many Americans would participate in the occupation of Germany. Many would be sent to the Pacific Theater or home to train for the Pacific. Filda Brodalski had cared for some of the wounded in the Normandy invasion. She had joined the army right after the attack on Pearl Harbor, where her older sister was a nurse when the Japanese attacked. Her entire family had been all in for the war effort for years, so the defeat of the Third Reich was significant.
We were in Leipzig, Germany, when the war ended. We were on an air base, a German air base, in the barracks there. And I think we were all relieved. I know that they brought some wax in on an airplane, and that night the hospital celebrated all over the place because we were happy. Finally, it was over, you know. And then it was a slow trip back home.
And how many siblings did you have serving in one part of the war or another?
Oh, I had a brother who was in the Navy, and I had a brother who was in Pan American Airlines, and they were drafted in to bring the supplies to Europe. Then I had an older sister who was a nurse who joined the Red Cross and took care of things on the home front. We made it back home without being wounded, too. That's another thing. I mean, we were in the middle of it, like Lee in Hawaii, but we didn't get hurt ourselves.
And after everything you saw in your personal experience, you know the odds of all four coming home with nothing is
rare. Very rare. No, I consider our family was lucky. Even my father became a guard at the gun factory because he wanted to do his part.
That family component is often overlooked when we focus on one individual veteran's contributions. The reality is so many who were celebrating victory 75 years ago had already had to deal with loss. Loss of fellow soldiers, sailors, airmen, and yes, sometimes of siblings as well. I spoke to my friend Niall Smith this week. He and his Scottish war bride Phyllis were in a very interesting spot 75 years ago. Niall had survived a horrific B-17 crash 13 months earlier. He was decorated for saving the lives of others, including the pilot, after a German night fighter intruder pilot had shot the plane down on its approach to an airbase in England.
I had a buddy worked up in personnel, and he came down and saw me. He says, "Hey, the war's going to be over tomorrow. I'm married by then, see. If you want to pass and you want to get out of here, you get your pass and get out, because they're throwing a restriction on the base. Nobody gets on or off when the announcement is made." So I got my pass. Phyllis and I were sitting in the theater in Edinburgh when Churchill came on the screen and announced the war was over.
Huh.
And here's all these other guys back at the base.
Was there a big cheer in the theater when that announcement was made?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And what did Winston Churchill have to say 75 years ago? Hear for yourself when we come back. Plus, stories from eight more veterans about where they were and how they experienced VE Day. Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
The German war is therefore at an end. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing Today is Victory in Europe Day.
The voice of Winston Churchill, 75 years ago, setting off celebrations throughout the UK and especially in London, where many Americans reveled in the news of victory in places like Trafalgar Square. I remember a decorated P-47 pilot named John Wiener telling me that's where he was, and May 8th, 1945 happened to be his 23rd birthday. That's quite a birthday party. Richard Christensen had been wounded 6 weeks earlier while serving with the 94th Infantry Division.
I was hit up in the left arm, and it took out the tricep.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't by the measure of some wounds. It wasn't really a great wound, but along the way, I got sent back to Paris and then from there back to England. And I think all of that came because of infection. And it took quite a while to, they did some more surgery when I got back to England.
What was that like to be in the hospital and hear, this is over, the Allies have won?
Actually, it was a wonderful experience. First of all, I was in a hospital on Easter that year also. And then the Germans capitulated, and that really was, that was a wonderful feeling. I was at that time able to get around pretty good, and I had met some English people, and it was really wonderful. The first Whitsuntide holiday was right after that. Whitsuntide is, as church people know, Pentecost.
Mm-hmm.
And the English people had not had any days off, any kind of celebrated days, since 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was away on that weekend, and that was really quite an experience to see how happy they were, how much they enjoyed a new kind of freedom. One of the interesting things about my getting out of the hospital, they gave me food stamps for the 10 days leave that I had, and I went to visit a relative of one of my uncles who was from England, and I went to see his sister, and I gave her all those stamps for food.
Mm-hmm.
And she came home the next day and put everything on one plate. She said, that's 10 days worth of stamps.
Wow.
And the English had been going through that since 1939. They were a brave and good people.
Another Purple Heart recipient in London that day was Duke O'Donnell, a B-17 bombardier with the 303rd Bomb Group.
Well, I was on leave that day. I was in London. And we used to get 2 days leave a month. And then we heard that we got two extra days because the war was over. So somebody said Churchill's going to come out of that building over there. So I stuck around and for a while and didn't come out. But Montgomery, Monty, came out. I saw him, Field Marshal Montgomery, head of the English Army. So, but I never did see Churchill come out.
But that had to be a pretty neat place to be, because London had been bombed so much throughout this war, and now victory is won. I bet there are a lot of excited people around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And London was a real desolate place, almost, in parts of it. There would be like blocks after blocks leveled, just nothing but rubble. They take maybe 8 or 9 blocks and take all the rubble off and pile them up in one block, make a huge pyramid of just old stone and the remains of buildings, rubble, really something to see.
So now that the war is over, I bet you wanted to come home.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, first we thought we'd be going to the Pacific, because the war in the Pacific was still going on. So we went to Liverpool and got in a cement boat. When I say cement boat, I don't mean they carried cement. It was made out of cement. There were a few of them like that. And so we left Liverpool for Boston, and we got out about halfway across the ocean. The war in the Pacific ended. So it took 13 days to come, because we broke down, I guess, about half one day, and drifted backwards toward England, as I got it. And then they ran out of food at the end, too. But we did, by that time, we didn't care because the last day, all we had to eat was ice cream.
That 20-year-old was just thankful he could eat anything and see anything after what had happened to him 5 months earlier on New Year's Eve.
Well, we went to briefing, of course, which is first before the mission, find out about the target and any defenses they might have down there, how many guns, if they know how many guns they have. Anyway, so then we took off, got flown toward the target, and I started seeing flak. And they had three types of ways to shoot flak, straight at the plane, or what we call tracking flak, which is the most accurate. They shoot ahead of you, and on the bomberman you can't deviate from course, so you have to fly right into it. And that was the case in this case. I looked up, and they had either four-gun batteries or six-gun batteries. And up ahead, I saw one shell go off, and then another one closer, and another one closer, and I knew they had at least four, and I knew the next we were going to be right there when I got hit. So I even said over the intercom, we're going to get hit. And the next thing I knew, I thought my head was gone, the top of my head was gone. I just sat there waiting to die. didn't bother me a bit. So anyway, I thought, well, maybe I'm not going to die right away. I can get these bombs out. So I told Mac, I said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs. So I was able to feel around. I couldn't see because I had glass in my eye. And he said, there they go. So I felt the toggle switch, which you can get the bombs out that way. And so I got them out that way. And then I was really out of my head for the rest of the day. Maybe ever since, I don't know. But anyway, so Max says, go back to the radio room. So I couldn't see, so I got up, and the top turret gunner, the engineer, helped me along. And I thought myself, I'll jump out of the plane to make it lighter. They can get back to England easier if I lighten the load up a little bit. You see how it was out of my head. So the engineer, DeWillers, took my parachute off. It was a chest pack, so I could get through the narrow catwalk to the radio room. And but I did have sense enough not to jump out without a parachute, huh? So anyway, I was going to jump out through the bomb bay doors, but anyway. So we went back to the radio room, and then we had to make a forced landing.
I didn't want to interrupt you because I wanted to hear the story from your perspective as you remember it. But people listening are saying, boy, this guy is describing this like it's no big deal. But the first thing you said was all of a sudden, after you saw, you know, one piece of flak closer, another burst closer, you told everyone we're going to get hit. The next thing you know, you thought the top of your head was blown off. So this flak exploded right in the nose of the plane, knocked out the plexiglass, knocked it into your eyes, and you're blind, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. No, couldn't see. The plexiglass, of course, that all crumbled, you know, breaks up in little pieces. I have my face, my eye, and my nose.
So it's basically like buckshot going into your face, only plexiglass.
Yeah, right. That's about it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't see. You're feeling your face. You probably feel a lot of blood, and you really thought that half your head was blown off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
But you stayed at your position to drop your bombs, and this is what your pilot, Bill McLeod, told me was so impressive that inspired the rest of your crew. They all wanted to take you back and give you medical attention. You said, no, I want to drop these bombs. But you're saying that wasn't necessarily a conscious thought, that you were pretty out of it.
You get so trained, I think, to it that dropping the bombs is the one thing you're thinking about. So you don't want to change your mind. You just want to get the bombs out and then figure out I wasn't too sensible either.
Did you ever find out how many pieces of plexiglass they pulled out of you?
No, I don't know. There were quite. There's still one in my nose, but it doesn't bother me any. And so I don't know how many they, you know, they probably threw them away. I don't know.
So the one that's still in your nose, you can feel it internally, or you can rub your finger over it and feel it?
I can feel it right. I'm feeling it right now. Yeah, it's up in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right inside of your left eye, there's a little spot on the bridge of your nose.
Right in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So at the time, you're still there in the bombardier position in the nose. Of course, the glass is shot out. Not that you could see it anyway. You're completely blind. And you needed help from your crew in order to know when to flip that switch and drop the bomb. So how did that work?
Well, I called Mac, the pilot, and said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs, because we were in formation. So when the other ones dropped their bombs, I was able to find this what they call a toggle switch and got them out that way.
You're just 19 years old at the time. You knew this was dangerous work before you got into it. In your heart of hearts, did you think you'd be coming home? Did you think you were going to see America again?
No, I tell you, the first few weeks there, we were losing planes. Well, we were losing like at least one plane a mission. We had to fly 35 missions, and we put up 39 planes. So I figured, well, my chances of getting back are 4 out of 39. They aren't very good. So I didn't think I was going to make it. I thought it's only a matter of days or weeks or months at the most, and I'm done for. So I didn't think I was going to get back, but I did.
Duke O'Donnell, one of the many Americans celebrating VE Day in London 75 years ago. Another was George Eldridge, also a bombardier, but on B-26s with the 344th Bomb Group. When I asked him what his most difficult moment of the war was, he didn't zero in on any of the close calls he survived, but on a situation that challenged him in a different way.
Probably the one when we went out to Rouen on the Rhine River. And did nothing because one of the airplanes on the way back went down and only one man bailed out of it. You just have to pack up their things, all of their belongings, and write letters to their family. The squadron commander has to do it, and all the crew members also had to do it if it was your crew member. And then in the case of many of your friends, you helped send letters back to the family.
That's something you had to do personally?
Oh, yes. And it had to have been handwritten. It couldn't be typed. I was in Belgium, but the squadron commander had left some things when we moved from England over to Belgium. He made arrangements that somebody would pick him up. And he said, because I was so close to coming home, and the war was just so close to over, he said, you're going to pick up this stuff, and you got a C-47. And we were back at Stansted, so naturally I went to London. I was there in May of 45. You can't imagine how many glasses were broken and thrown out on the streets. Glass on the streets was just solid. I don't know how anybody walked on there. Nobody was barefoot, I'll tell you that. GIs with their girlfriends, or with any girl they could find, hanging out of every window on both sides of the streets all across London. And the British soldiers and airmen, they really got drunk.
Victory in Europe meant a turning of the tide. Servicemen and civilians could start to pick up the pieces. You heard George Eldridge talk about airmen who never came back from their missions. One of the efforts that began in earnest after VE Day was the quest to recover some of their remains. That would be one of the duties of Vito Mastrangelo, who had been tasked with burying the fallen since he landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day.
Was that a relief for you to hear that the war was over?
Yes, very much so.
I bet.
And so we had nothing to do for a while till new orders came in. My order was, take a few men with you. I want you to stop to every little village in Germany. There was no road. You had to take down a fence, drive through, hook up the fence to find the mayor. He might be out there cutting wheat with the scythe. The words to him with Bunt Kistner, the German interpreter, were any air crews killed in your vicinity? And he would say yes or no. If it was yes, where are they buried? He would take us to the German cemetery. They were generally buried at a corner of the cemetery. So we would mark how many. They would say, well, they had 55. So we make records of it. A few days later, the digging crews came behind us and picked them up. And we did that until about November. That's all we did.
So for 6 months, you're going around to every little town.
Every little village, yeah.
And if you guys weren't doing this,
they would still be there.
And no one would know where they were.
No, that's right.
Because if you didn't have that immediate knowledge of the person there then,
yes,
it would be needle in a haystack.
Yeah, you wouldn't know at all.
So that work for 6 months,
yeah.
I bet it's still as morbid as this whole thing is. That probably has to be satisfying knowing what you did for all those families.
That's right.
It's time for another break, but when we come back, another D-Day survivor on how he experienced the bookend to those 11 intense months on the European continent, as well as veterans who experienced May 8th, 1945 in different settings. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on the 75th anniversary of a day that brought relief and hope. Victory in Europe was announced May 8, 1945. Phil Benson had landed on France's shores on June 6, 1944 with the 6th Engineers Special Brigade. May 8, 1945 brought much more pleasant memories.
Rumors start spreading, the war is over. And I said, where in the world did that come from? And as soon as we got on the street, there were just thousands of French women with loaves of bread, La Guerre Finie. And that was...
The war is over.
Yeah. And that was an emotional thing for me.
Did any of those French women plant a kiss on you?
Not me. We were marching down the street. I wouldn't have refused one.
Sure. Did you think the war was over for you, or did you wonder, I might still have something to do?
Oh, I thought it was over, but... I didn't think that I'd be going home the next day. They took us and sent us to where the Germans still had submarine pens, and they never gave up, and they were still there. So we formed the perimeter around the Germans, and we were facing out to keep the French from going back in. So we did that for a week or whatever. And then we left, and they sent us to Germany. I was glad that it ended. I can't get over it. I can't tell you the joy I heard when they said the war was over. I can't describe it.
And they even said it in French.
Oh, yeah, La Guerre Finie.
Some of the celebrating servicemen had been fighting for years, others just a matter of weeks. But the news of victory was just as welcome. Sam Terasaki was a 20-year-old mortarman with the 100th Infantry Battalion, also known as the Purple Heart Battalion. It had been attached to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
You know, as an infantryman or mortarman, you don't get the latest news. In fact, some of the old-timers knew that the war was going to end then. We never knew that.
When did you figure it out, and what did it mean to you?
Didn't believe it. We were in a town northern Italy after we had captured a number of Germans and had them on the run. I was in a town, spent a miserable night in this town square, rained all night, covered myself with my shelter half, and woke up in the morning and all kinds of native Italians running around said the war is over. I didn't believe them, but it was shortly after that an observation plane flew over and dumped the bundles of the Stars and Stripes and said the war is over. That's when I knew.
How big of a relief was that?
Oh, you don't. I remember none of the guys jumped up and down or anything. It just kind of took it as a matter of fact. We were happy that it was over, and it was a day or two later we had a memorial service at an abandoned warehouse. Our chaplain delivered a sermon and read the names of all the guys in the 100th from the first one that was killed down in Salerno. Very sad. Couldn't help from crying.
I believe it. And I'm sure, even though, as you're telling it, there was only about a month that you spent in real intense combat, that had to be the longest month of your life, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And sure, there had to be days in there where you thought your name could have been one of those chaplains reading.
Well, maybe wondered why I'd survived and the others didn't.
Did you have days where you thought that was going to be it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Pray to God. pray to God when we're under artillery fire that the next one wouldn't come over and hit us.
It's got to be a pretty helpless feeling.
It is. What do? Put your hands over your head and hug the ground as much as you can and hope that you don't get hit. I know I recited the Lord's Prayer all the time.
I'm just imagining being in those shoes and how lonely and scary and just difficult that must have been.
It was. It was scary. When your legs start shaking, you can't stop it from shaking. That's when I knew I was scared.
And you mentioned that memorial service while you're still there in Italy, and the war has just ended, and they're reading off name after Japanese surname. Some of those guys are probably guys you knew?
Yeah.
And you told, you're crying.
Yeah.
How should we, today, remember those guys whose names you heard read that day?
Well, I don't know. I just live a good life. Pay them back by living a good life and being tolerant.
The next veteran we're going to hear from is Jim Gerhardt of the 736th Medium Tank Battalion. Before we hear why his location on May 8, 1945 was so meaningful, we need to hear what he went through 10 weeks earlier on February 25th.
We hit a couple of anti-personnel mines, which just shake you up a little is all. It's a little startling, but it doesn't hurt anything. Tank commander stopped the tank to assist somebody else, and about that time we took a round, a German round, 88, through the engine compartment. As I found out later from a retriever, the round came through the engine compartment, right down the dead center of the two engines, the two Cadillac engines, took off all the spark plugs, went through the firewall into the turret, and then exploded inside the turret where we were sitting. You don't remember anything about an explosion. You get a big red flash, your ears start ringing. You don't really feel any pain. You don't really know what happened either. And I know when I came to, I knew that I'd been hit, of course, but the explosion ripped open my jacket, zipper. I didn't get blinded right then, but my eyes burned, of course. My ears were still ringing. In one hand, I had a glove on for handling hot shells. And one gland was bare, and when the shell went off, it was only 2 feet away or so. So my left side got pretty well tore apart, and the tank commander, he was on the other side of the turret. His right side got all tore up because he was on the opposite side. The gunner who was in front of it was only about a foot from the explosion. He was killed. The driver right in front of him was also killed. The turret raised in the air and came back down and trapped the assistant driver inside the tank, so he was stuck there, and there was no way to get him out, and so he burned it as in the tank. I finally got out through the turret, because I left my turret open, because I considered that 5/8 inch of armor on the tank is not going to stop anything coming through anyway. And so I went out to the top, and I discovered two men, engineers, on the back of our tank. And so I pulled them off the tank and took them with me out into a 105 hole out in the middle of the field to wait for medics. And while we're out there, they kept throwing mortar shells and a few rounds of 88s out in the field. And a couple of them, two mortar shells landed alongside of us, and both of them duds. But then one of the bombs went off, and it blew another hole not too far from us. And some of the fragments came down and burned us from that. That was about 9 o'clock in the morning, and we were out there till almost 5 that afternoon before the medics, well, I can't say the medics because it wasn't the medics that came after us. Our own people came after us. We didn't have any medics come out after us. And they took us back to the aid station. Of course, by this time, I know I got a leg busted up and bad, and I had a tournament on it, and I doctored up the other two guys with sulfa drugs to keep them from getting infected or poisoned. And they evacuated them too, and they took me back to an aid station. And they gave me a nice shot of morphine, which made me feel pretty good. Then they put me on a jeep. Oh, when they was picking me up, they put me on a board. They didn't have a stretcher. They put me on a board. And when they did, they twisted my leg, and which was quite painful. And if there was any new cuss words invented, I invented them that day. And they probably could have heard me as far as Berlin, because I was really upset. And they got me back to the aid station. They fixed me up there a little bit. They put me on a jeep. They also put blankets around me because I was freezing. And it was cold. It was in February morning. It was February
25th, yeah. And it was still freezing weather. And so when I got on this Jeep, they put one blanket over me, and it took about a mile before that blanket was gone. So by the time I got to the hospital in Liège, Belgium, I was almost frozen again. And then they put me on a stretcher to take me up to the room where they put you in to put you in line to be the next operated on. They had a buzz bomb come over, which was a German, kind of a jet air, gasoline jet engine thing. And it exploded. It landed and exploded in the courtyard of the hospital. And the German prisoners, they dropped me, and so I skidded all the way down the stairs, bounced from step to step down a whole flight of stairs. And they finally got me upstairs, and they put me in the hallway. By this time, of course, I'm blind. I can't see anything, can't hear much either. So I heard somebody ask me if I wanted a cigarette, and of course I said sure. I didn't know if I could smoke or not, since most of my face, my left side of my face was burned, and my hands were burned, a few other things. And they had already cut my helmet off because it was burned to my head. So they had to cut it off already. Then somebody asked me a cigarette, and later I found out it was the movie star Van Johnson that had offered me this cigarette. Then I remember going into the operating room, and they had us all in cots there, and they took my temperature. And when they took my temperature, the thermometer was so cold that I actually broke it. My cheeks were chattering. And they asked me, told me it was my time for me to go, and I said, well, take this guy next to me. He's hell of a lot better off, worse off than I am. And so they took him, and everything went all right. They fixed me up. They wrapped me up from, primarily from head to toe with bandages. So when I was in them, took me to the ward. And, of course, the only problem I had there was, the only thing I had open was my mouth had a bandage across my whole face, of course. I had enough room for a spoon to get through. And I had a French nurse that every time she asked me something, which I didn't know what she was saying, she'd stick something in my mouth to eat. And if I tried to tell her no, I'd get something else stuck in my mouth. And that was the only bad part about it. And then about a week later, I had this somebody, a doctor I assumed, ask me about my eyes. I said, well, I feel all right. When's this? Well, I didn't use particularly nice language about this doctor down there who's going to see about my eye, this colonel. He says, well, we'll see about what we can do. So the next day, they took me down, unbanged my eyes, and I could see enough to see light and figures. And it turned out the guy I cussed out was the colonel to start with. So anyway, I got away with it. Then we got on the plane. They just happened to put me next to the door, and I was in the top bunk. I didn't have my blankets. They had taken my blankets away from me. I didn't have blankets over my feet. My one foot, my right foot, was almost blue from cold by the time I got to England. And I got off of the plane in England. They put us in an ambulance. Now, an English ambulance is about, three decks high, three bunks high. And you ride in it like you're in a ship going through a storm because it rocks back and forth. And you're sure it's going to fall over. Anyhow, we finally get to the hospital. We go in the hospital, and then the only thing I really appreciated there was white sheets, and they gave me a quart of milk. And it was first white sheets and quart of milk I've had in almost a year.
I'm struck, and I know that you lived this, and I'm sure there have been many nights you thought about it. You've told the story a few times. But to hear you describe it so matter-of-factly, I can't help but think of how horrifying all of this is. I mean, you're hit to begin with this 88 shell right through your tank. You're incapacitated just about. You find your way out of the tank. You're hit again by mortar fire. You're more concerned about these other guys with you. You're helping take care of them. You end up blind for a few weeks. It's going to take you more than 9 months to recover and get back to health. In those kind of moments, for instance, from 9 in the morning till 5 o'clock, waiting in a hole in the ground that one of the American artillery had made, hoping that someone's going to come rescue you, what do you do for that time? What's going through your mind, and how did you believe that you were actually going to make it through all of this?
Well, I knew I was going to make it. I had no doubts about that. I knew I was bad enough that I might wind up with a leg being off, but that really didn't concern me too much. I was still alive. I was still one piece.
The enemy was still firing your way.
First they got to hit me. So far they haven't hit me.
So it didn't bother you. And it didn't bother you when the buzz bomb hit the hospital and the German prisoners dropped you down a flight of stairs when you're already in all kinds of pain?
A little more pain didn't matter anymore at that time.
Now, whenever I interview a veteran who served in the European theater, I like to ask him about May 8th, 1945, VE Day, the day that part of the war came to an end. Of course, your war ended on February 25th of 45, really. But I think May 8th has some special significance to you, too. Why is that?
That's my day I came back to the United States. I got off with General Huddleston, the hospital ship, in Charleston, South Carolina, on May the 8th at 9 o'clock in the morning, and there was nobody on the dock but the medical personnel and a few Red Cross workers, the buses or whatever it was going to take us to the hospital. They had no celebration or anything else, and we had just been told as we were getting off the ship that the war was over. And that's how where I was on May the 8th. It was right there on the ship, getting off.
What a day to come back to a country you weren't sure you'd ever see again. If we were to share all the VE Day memories we've heard on Hometown Heroes over the years, we might be here until the 76th anniversary. I'm reminded of my own grandfather's VE Day story. He remembered a sign outside a church in Germany, which he translated to say, "The air raid shelter is in the sun." Takes a moment for that one to sink in. And perhaps no one appreciated the significance of VE Day more than newly liberated prisoners of war. Camp Lucky Strike was a hastily constructed tent city in Le Havre, France, where so many ex-POWs arrived. Fighter pilot Ray Maloney had been flown into Lucky Strike from Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany, on May 7th. He spent VE Day, like so many other starving ex-POWs, trying to put some meat back on his bones. I think the best way to end today's journey back in time is to hear about the opportunity that victory in Europe created for Ray and so many more who had learned what it was like to live in the absence of freedom.
Priority for going home was wounded first, and then POWs, and then guys that had done their tours. And Eisenhower came through the camp, and I didn't sit at the table with them. They had these long tables, and they were feeding us five times a day, small meals, but five times a day. And they were trying to put some meat on us because we all looked like skeletons, you know. And that's what the delay was being caused. The medics were saying, keep the meal, let's fatten them up before they,
sure,
they go home. And but Eisenhower came through and stopped and had lunch with us. And he was, you know, talking to everybody. And we were saying, General, can we go home? Can we go home? Eisenhower said, well, we're trying to get you home in style. We don't want you to have a rough crossing. But he said, you know, an option we're considering, but we haven't done anything, was to double load you, you know, half sleep and half stay on deck, and then in reverse.
You get twice as many people since the bunks aren't
on the ships.
Twice
as many on the ships, yeah.
Yeah.
And we said, we don't care, General. Take us home. And so we came home that way, double loaded. They started to move out, I think, the very next day after Eisenhower, you know, gave the word. Another one of my most emotional moments of my military career was we came into New York City, and we was, you know, as I said, the wounded came first, and then the POW. So we were very early in returning, and of course the country was still celebrating, you know, the fact that we had won. And as we're coming up the straits, you know, Staten Island and Brooklyn on one side, you know, the New York Harbor. Along the, on the Brooklyn side, there was a kind of grassy bank, and they had a sign in plants, you know, all very cleverly done. And here I go, I'm going to say, the sign said, "Welcome home, well done." I can't even, I'm sorry.
What message could have meant more to you in that moment than that?
It was heaven.
Ray Maloney, the 10th and final veteran's voice you're hearing from today. Hopefully this hour has helped us all understand a little more fully just how significant the news of victory was 75 years ago. There's much more with each one of those 10 veterans online at hometownheroesradio.com. And let me close with a request, an assignment, if you will. If you have any surviving World War II veterans in your life, call them up this weekend. Ask them what VE Day meant to them. Maybe they'll turn instead to VJ Day, or maybe it'll open up another decades-old story you've never heard before. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.